the public's input, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, please come up to the microphone up in the front, state your name and address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have all five commissioners present, and Ann should be here in just a minute. We have two commissioners on the phone, Commissioner Smith and Arsenal, are joining us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
And we have General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfine present as well. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute led by Maria Kininger. Do I say that right, Maria?
Kininger.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So March is Eye Safety Month, and I don't know about you, but for me, I think of eye safety, I think of construction workers, welding, those types of jobs where bits of debris are flying through the air, and you need safety goggles as a part of your daily necessity. I don't typically think of a person working at a computer. However, with so many people on computers these days, eye strain, difficulty focusing, and eye discomfort have become commonplace complaints in doctors' offices. So here are some tips to alleviate eye strain. Get an eye exam. It can eliminate the possibility of eye disease. Some eye diseases cause pain, discomfort. So it's good to eliminate that. Screen distance. You should sit 20 inches from your computer monitor and have it at or below eye level. It also helps if it tilts or swivels and has both contrast and brightness controls. Use a document holder. This will decrease the need to turn your neck and for your eyes to constantly refocus. Modify the lighting to help eliminate glare or reflections, or use a screen filter. Also, forced air heating systems can cause dry eyes, so use an over-the-counter eye drops to help alleviate the symptoms.
Great. Thank you, Marie.
Thank you.
Timely this time of year.
Yep, and I was just operating as a prop, putting eye drops in as you were doing that, so I concur.
Commissioners, it's time to approve the agenda for this morning. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request or additions to the agenda? We're all good?
I think we're good this morning.
All right. Agenda will stand. All right.
We'd like to start with our monthly cycle of personal ownership winner. I invite Adam Cooey up to the table. So Adam did something very cool and very fitting to, as we've just finished a safety moment here. So he, doing his job, overheard a conversation, had to do with lockout, tagout, very important in our business to make sure that you've got isolation around things that are energized. He recognized that
so. Gary or Andy, we're picking up a lot of noise from your end.
Sorry.
That seemed to take care of it. he recognized that there might be something that was not well understood, and so he took it upon himself to go find out if, in fact, things were understood the way that they had been described. And it turned out they were not, which really made a difference. So this is just what we're looking for in terms of behaviors. We're looking for people that recognize that they can make a difference, make this they have important and meaningful work. And Adam was a great example of that. So we just wanted to recognize him and give him a moment. We always tell folks they come here, we welcome them to come. They could share something with the board if they want to, but they're not required to. And so we'll give him a chance.
Well, discussing it
this with you guys. A couple of you brought up, you know, that you were grateful that there was an atmosphere where I felt comfortable doing that. And I had actually taken that for granted before you guys said that. I never worked professionally anywhere else. Definitely never anywhere with like a, you know, emphasis on safety like there is here. You know, swamping cherries. You know, I was prior to this. And I do agree that part of what made me feel comfortable to speak out is the culture here at the district. And I had taken that for granted before you guys actually mentioned that. Right.
Yeah, that's great. That's good to hear.
I appreciate you saying that. I was going to say the only thing that makes me happier than your willingness to do that is the culture that would allow you to freely do that and bring that forward. When we do that and we have that culture, it only makes us better. If we ever stray from that culture, we need to remedy that quickly.
And I'm sure, Adam, you gained those basic skills attending Eastern as an Eagle. And
yes, profoundly, in fact, yeah.
I happen to know his parents pretty well, and I think that might have been established a little bit before Eastern, but comes from a great family with high expectations and very, very, very good people. So you represent your family very well today as well.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Adam, you can't hide, can you?
No.
it's all around you.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate your help. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Adam.
Good work. Thanks.
Go ahead, Randy.
Well, you got to love a small community. You can't get away from anybody.
No. Helps me.
Okay. Legislative update.
Yep. Next up, I want to invite Tracy Hunt and Sean Seaman to come forward and once again provide you an update on what's going on in Olympia.
Good morning. Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs.
Sean Seaman with External Affairs.
So this morning we're going to hit on a number of summary items. Sean's going to go through and discuss, and then we're going to spend a little bit more time on the status and events surrounding the clean energy legislation. So, Sean?
So quickly, just some bills and note. I won't go through the whole list. On the number three, distributed generation customer billing, there was a concern in one of the bills having to do with data on that we would provide on a customer's bill. And working with the sponsor and others in industry, we got that modified to something we can live with. So we're happy to see that change in a net metering bill. That bill's progressing forward at this point. And minimal impact from the district overall on net metering issues. Jumping ahead, electric vehicles, there's many vehicles moving the electric vehicle bill ahead. There's three different bills. Some of them are strictly some authority issues, the PUDs and investor-owned utilities have sought. We're focusing on those, the bill that's that simple. Others are broader, part of the governor's request. But the information, the bill language that the customer-owned utilities liked, as did the investor-owned utilities, is now in these bills and moving forward. So we're happy to see that in these EV bills. Wildfire liability, I think you know at this point, those are still moving forward. The bill itself, recall, was reduced to pretty much a task force, a work group bill. And some of the other issues, Section 2 regarding some liability issues have been taken out for now. But those bills, the House and Senate version, are moving forward, continue to move forward. The broadband access bill, the Senate bill has now made it out of Ways and Means. And there were some amendments to that included the two things that WAPUTA was looking for. One was to have the safe harbor language extended from the current 6 months of the bill to 12 months. And that happened as an amendment in Ways and Means, as was the bill to have an expert panel review applications for grants and loans under the broadband program, as opposed to having staff at the UTC do that. So that was amended, both those into the Senate version of the bill unanimously, which is good, and it moved out of committee and into rules and eventually the floor. The House version has moved out of its committee onto the floor without those amendments, but we get indications that with a strong support in the Senate, we could see that either change in the House version or we'll continue to support the Senate version instead. So that's good news.
I think we're going to call the Safe Harbor Amendment the Coleman Amendment. A lot of time Mike has spent on this.
The bid limits bills, the Senate bill or the House bill is in rules. And this is good for us. It means it's alive. The Senate bill, though, hadn't moved out of its local government, so we're not sure the status of that at this point, but we have one of the versions still moving forward. Just a couple other minor issues. There was an issue to have a bill down in number 10 in the other energy. There was an on-payment bill requirement that we would have had to offer on the bill, energy loan, energy conservation loans, a repayment process through the bill. And thank you to Representative Jake Pye from Tacoma. That was moved to a option, a voluntary program, as opposed to a mandatory program. Very happy to see that.
Sean, sorry to interrupt. What was his name?
Jake Pye. Representative Pye.
F-Y? F-Y-E?
F-E-Y.
F-E-Y?
Yes.
Thank you.
Strong supporter of public power, so we're happy to have mm-hmm. him on our side. And there was two other bills that we were watching carefully. One had to do, there was multiple bills around defining independent contractors, which would have had an impact on some of the staff that we use from a staffing agency. That was reduced much opposition across the state to a study bill. So again, a good study bill is better than having a mandatory bill. And there was one bill to electrify public fleets, even up into heavy and medium duty vehicles out into the 2040s. That was reduced again to a study bill. So I'm happy to say no longer have to watch that one carefully. And with that, if there's any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, hand it over to Tracy.
Any questions?
No, I think that's a really nice summary. Thank you.
So moving now to what is taking a great deal of effort in Olympia is the clean energy legislation. So the House and the Senate originally each had a bill. The Senate bill has gained traction. The House bill has been put down. So it is now going to be working between the House and the Senate. So House Bill 5116 did pass out of the Senate Friday. It had some changes. It is over in the House. It is a carbon neutral bill by 2030, and it's a carbon free planning goal by 2045. So I was going to outline some things that we like about it, some things we'd like to see changed, and then what we would likely recommend should those items get changed in the coming days or weeks. So first, it is a energy sector only bill. It only applies to our sector, whereas in the past we've seen legislation that includes transportation and other sectors. We've all had discussions about public policy that does not include hydropower as a defined renewable resource. This bill does include hydropower as a renewable resource. There's also language in there that would allow IOUs to be indifferent financially to buying a power purchase contract versus building a new resource. IOUs receive a rate of return on building new resources. This would make it indifferent so that they could actually buy a contract and have the same incentive to buy, for example, from us versus building a new generation resource. So those are some of the things that we like. There are some things that are still in the works, a couple of them very important, and they seem to be trending, I'll say, in general in a positive direction, but we obviously will not know until we see them. First is we're essentially creating a clean energy standard within the Western U.S. that has a lot of markets that are either established or under development. So it's really complicated. And understanding how it's going to fit with energy imbalance market or other markets is going to be a challenge. This legislation has identified, or the sponsors have identified, a willingness to include the development of a stakeholder group to further dig into how these markets would fit together. That's a lot better than, we hope it works, here are the rules. So we want to see that market integration, for lack of a better term, stakeholder group proceed. We also know that hydro, some years we have high-level production, some years we have low. What does a critical water year mean for hydro producers if this legislation passes? So protections in those years where there is a critical water year. How the specific actions that are taken, how utilities plan for those low water years. So this is something that's still being worked on and we're focusing on. We're also very concerned that we don't want legislation that would lead to the requirement or the need for utilities to build new generation resources before the system actually needs it. That will increase costs. And then finally, and this is the one that we've been spending a great deal of time on, Senator Hawkins has really been working hard on this specific issue as well, is tax parity, which treats all renewables the same. There is an existing exemption that is being proposed for extending 10 years, sales tax exemption. And right now, it applies to wind and solar, for example, but does not include hydropower. We believe it should be comparable, should be the same. We're calling it tax parity. One specific aspect of that is the sales tax would only be for the state portion of the sales tax. It would not include revenues to the counties, so it wouldn't have an impact there. But it is a substantial impact for Chelan, Douglas, and Grant, and a number of utilities that have all signed a letter in support. We have a long ways to go on this. The House is over, or the bill is over in the House. Representative Steele as and Representative Gaynor have both been in discussions, have expressed support for this tax parity concept. We're going to be working with them to see if we can't get some traction on getting these provisions put into the House bill while it's over in the House. Still a long ways to go. If we see the tax parity, the stakeholder group, protections for critical water years, and protections from building resources before we need it, if all of those stars align, it's likely that staff would recommend that we support this legislation as a benefit to our ratepayers. But there's a lot of work that we still have to do.
So who's the actual, Tracy, sponsor of the bill? Well, I mean, not the bill. It's not a separate bill, but.
Well, so the bill right now, Reuven Carlisle is the sponsor, and there's a whole list. I don't know if I brought the list with me. And then that's in the Senate side, and that's the bill that is moving ahead. And we've also been in contact with members of the House to try to express our interests, especially on the tax parity issue. But it's Reuven Carlisle.
Thank you.
Yeah, he seems to have been at least cooperative, approachable, I think, through the process, at least during the last year's conversations.
Yes, he and Senator Hawkins facilitated Senator Carlisle to actually visit Wenatchee this past summer and was very open to hearing what we and others had to say about our interests. And one of the challenges is describing the complexities of all these markets and the decisions that are in front of Chelan, PUD, and others for reinvesting. And that's a challenge that I think we might be making some headway as describing. These are not cut-and-dried decisions. They're very tight financial decisions on what we do. It isn't a foregone conclusion of future actions. And Steve has had conversations with folks, Reuven being one of them, Senator Carlisle, to try to describe the complexity of these markets and try to do it in 15 minutes is very difficult. But I think we might be getting some, at least awareness, which is a long-term benefit for us to describe how these decisions are made for us, and they're not just simple yes-no answers.
Any other questions? No. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you.
I just want to emphasize how appreciative we are of what Senator Hawkins has done in the last month in particular. He's been very aggressive on this and very helpful to us.
Yes.
Steve?
Yes.
just a comment from a commissioner that's been around for 12 years now, and we've been working on establishing hydro clearly as a renewable with respect of the entire community, and this bill is huge. I mean, I would not want to understate how far we've come in 12 years since Initiative 937 and the importance of this bill. So I want to thank staff and thank a lot of people for all the hard work they're putting into it.
Thanks, Randy. Okay. Next up, we want to talk about Rock Island Capital Projects funding. Heather Ireland and Debbie Litchfield will be presenting.
Good morning. I'm Debbie Litchfield, treasurer for the district, and with me is Heather Ireland, our lead treasury analyst. And we're here with you today to share a component of the 2019 plan of finance that was discussed with the board at the end of last year and to address some funding needs for Rock Island Hydro. Because of the district's strong financial position and the benefits that we've seen from the long-term power sales contracts, we've not had to do any external bond financing or loans for a number of years, since at least 2013. So this process may be new to some of you, and for others, this will probably be a bit of a refresher. So for the Treasury team, we've conducted external bond financings nearly every year from 1996, when I joined the Treasury Department, through 2013. So the team's very knowledgeable and prepared to take the steps to ensure that we have a successful financing activity. Specifically for today, we would like to share with you a proposal for capital funding for Rock Island Hydro. The information that we're going to be sharing with you today is information only. We do plan to come back in a couple weeks with a resolution. And we'll provide an overview for you of the accounting and the internal loan process and discuss Rock Island's funding needs specifically. So with that, to provide more detail, I'll turn it over to Heather.
Good morning. I wanted to start today with some background about the district's various systems, which I think will be helpful in understanding Rock Island capital needs and how we're proposing to fund those in the upcoming years. To start with, the district does have multiple systems that are accounted for separately due to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission requirements and also some bond covenants on some older bonds that we have outstanding still. For example, we track the revenues and expenses of the Rock Island, Rocky Reach, and Lake Chelan hydro systems separately, which also means that for accounting purposes, each system also has its own assets and liabilities, including cash and loan balances. We have multiple other systems in the district that we utilize, for example, the distribution system. So for our transmission and distribution lines here in the county, we have a separate accounting system for that system. And we also have an internal system that we refer to as our financing system, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Our external reporting that the district does, our for financial reporting, does include both the district on a combined basis and the individual systems separately reported. What that means is that on a combined basis, the district can have very healthy cash reserves and no need for external borrowing. But internally, an individual system, because it's accounted for separately, can have a need for a cash funding source. That's where internal loans come in. They help us match system funding needs with available system cash. We can utilize the cash in one accounting system to help support the funding needs in another accounting system. We accomplish that with an internal loan between those accounting systems. And how that's done is the cash is actually moved at the beginning of the loan to the system that needs the funds, and then it's paid back over time with principal and interest components to the loaning system. Historically, we do have a system that's set up for that. We refer to it as our financing system. It's a shared system, and we use it to track and record various bond and loan activity. It's our primary source of internal loans when one system needs cash funding. So since we've covered a little bit of how our accounting systems and internal loan process works, I think what's important today to focus on more is why are we talking about this in the first place? And the reason for doing that really is Rock Island capital funding needs. Historically, hydro capital funding has been done primarily with bond proceeds, external funding sources. One major driver of that was that our prior long-term power sales contracts had a requirement to borrow for most of the capital expenses in those systems. Really, we were using external bond funds to finance all activity of those hydro systems from about the 1950s up until the early 2000s. Really, we did have a change in 2011 and 12 when the current long-term cost-plus power sales contracts with Alcoa and Puget went into effect. We've been able to utilize pay-as-you-go capital funding under those contracts for in the last few recent years. And one of the reasons for that is some of those contract adders that are in the contracts. They contemplate being able to fund a portion of capital pay-as-you-go. However, in years where you have very large capital programs that are larger than average, the contracts do not have adders that are sufficient to cover that entire capital program. The way the contracts are structured, it allows more for collection of additional contract adders to pay for a portion of the capital, but long term, it may not be enough to fund 100% of the capital, and that will fluctuate in years. For example, since 2011-12, Rock Island's capital program has been slightly lower than average, which has allowed us to use those funds to pay for capital. But in 2019 and 2020, we're anticipating very large capital programs at Rock Island, totaling over those 2 years alone of about $128 million. And that amount will exceed the available resources in the Rock Island system by itself. So there will be some additional funding required. Since we've talked about capital projects that can be funded with available cash, which is what we've been doing in the Rock Island hydro system for the last few years, but that is not a source that will be available over the next couple years to fully fund that program, there are some additional options. Those include using internal loans or external bond proceeds. We look first to determine what method we would recommend using based on our long-term board-affirmed debt philosophy and planning strategies. And that strategy says that first we would look to internal loans from unrestricted reserves when those funds are available. Right now, the district does have very healthy unrestricted cash reserve balances, and so that's where we would plan to look first. In addition, using internal funds when available and economically feasible does provide benefits for our customer owners. One of the reasons is that it does support our debt leverage and coverage metrics. It helps keep our debt leverage levels lower, which we've seen in recent years by being able to pay for nearly all of our capital pay-as-you-go. That's helped us reduce those debt balances. It also supports having lower annual debt service payments, which means our coverage metrics are improved. If we don't have as high of external outstanding debt balances, we therefore don't have as high of debt payments. In addition, it avoids external bond issuance and interest costs. Every time we do an external bond issuance, there are costs associated with going to the market. We do pay fees to our underwriters. We pay fees to external bond and disclosure counsel. And we can avoid those costs if we do internal loan funding. It also avoids paying interest costs to bondholders. In addition, in almost all market environments, using available unrestricted cash to fund capital produces an actual real positive impact between the interest rates on those two sources of funding. In most markets, if the district was to borrow at a long-term rate, we would have to pay our bondholders a higher amount than we could earn on a short-term investment rate. That's true today also, which is why we're currently recommending that we would pursue an internal loan for Rock Island capital funding. There is a board resolution that establishes internal loan procedures. That's Resolution 13-13830. It's adopted in 2013 by the board. The resolution does specify that the loan needs would be determined by the Asset Liability Management Committee. That's an internal district working group that meets quarterly. It includes members from all departments of finance as well as business advisors. And that group gets together quarterly to review and discuss what the internal loan or external loan needs would be and then make recommendations around that. In addition, the resolution specifies that the financing system would be the primary issuer of loans and that there needs to be an authorizing loan resolution anytime an internal loan is affected that would identify both the issuing and borrowing systems and also the specific loan terms, like the duration of the loan and the interest rate on the loan. The resolution also specifies that for the Rocky Reach and Rock Island systems specifically, that any internal loan terms would follow those that are defined in the long-term cost-plus power sales contracts. So those loan terms, if we look to the power sales contracts, specify that there would be essentially a 25-year loan term. It would be level debt service, which means it's like a mortgage. There'd be a monthly payment that's fixed each month, and that would be paid over the 25 years.
Heather, that's not to exceed 25 years, correct?
Not to exceed 25 years.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. It also defines how the interest rate is determined on each loan. The interest rate is a fixed rate, and it is set up on the date of issuance of the internal loan. It's based on external markets, and we would rely on our external investment banker to provide that rate to us. It assumes that the district's credit is borrowing for that 25-year period on a taxable basis so that the bonds would not be a tax-exempt rate. And it assumes that that rate is 110% of what the market rate would be. So there's a slight adder to what the external market rate is to cover the administrative costs of doing an internal loan.
Question on the phone.
Sure, Randy.
Knowing the not to exceed 25 year, are most of the assets that we would be anticipating have a useful, depreciable life of much longer than 25 years? How does that match up?
Yes. So the actual language in the power sales contract is that the loan term would be established based on the lesser of 25 years or the average service life of the assets to be financed. Because we typically are looking at Rocky Reach and Rock Island hydro assets that have very long service lives, most of them are in the 40 to 50 year range. In almost all cases, internal loans to the Rocky Reach and Rock Island hydro systems are going to have that 25-year loan life because that is going to be the lesser of the average service life or the 25-year term.
Thank you.
Sure.
Do we have any outstanding loans against Rock Island at this current time?
Yes. We have not done an internal loan to the Rock Island system, I believe, since 2009 or 10. I can't remember the exact year the last one was done. But those loans that were done under the old power sales contracts are still outstanding.
Okay.
And they're being repaid over time. Those were fixed in place in 2006 under what we refer to as the Schedule A1 that was attached to the power sales contracts. And then there was a period of time between 2006 and the go-live date of 2011-12 where there were some additional loans that had kind of some different rules on how they worked. But basically, those schedules are fixed, and those are paid off over time. And those lengths of loans, some of them had lengths into the 30- and 40-year range.
Correct.
Based on the average service lives of those assets that were being financed. It was not based on the lesser of 25 mm-hmm. years or the average service life. It was based on average service life.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
So those will be paid off over time, too.
Could you get those to us?
Sure. We can give you the balances. There's quite a list. Mm-hmm. We do track those of what the loans are, but we can get you the balances in that detail.
Just
as well.
The balances. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then I have one question about the contract adders that increase with the debt as the debt
yes.
balance increases. What would be a couple of those?
Let's see if those are on.
Those are per the contract, the right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the contracts do specify that in addition to the purchasers contributing a share of the principal and interest payments over time, there are also certain contract adders that do increase with debt balances. So, for example, a good one would be the Puget Sound Energy contract has a debt administration fee. It's 1% of the outstanding debt balance. Which includes both external borrowings at the system and also internal loans. So if there is a higher loan balance at Rock Island, that 1% debt administration fee would go up. Alcoa has a credit rating premium fee. It's calculated in the same manner, but their rate is different, and their rate changes every year. We set it in the first week of January every year. So that is another example of one of the contract adders that would increase if the balance.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Is higher. I do remember now that the credit, the Alcoa credit, how you
credit rating premium.
Credit rating. That's right. Premium. Yeah. Thanks.
Heather, this is Gary Arso.
Sure.
I have a question. I think I might know the answer, but I wanted just to confirm the assignment of taxable interest rates versus tax-free interest rates. Can you go into detail on that?
Sure. Historically, the district has had access at our hydro capital projects to borrow on a limited tax-exempt authority basis. In 1986, I believe it was, There were some changes to the federal tax laws, and out of that came a concession or an agreement that the Mid-Columbia PUDs could continue to borrow on a tax-exempt rate, which is basically a rate that the owners of the bonds would not have to pay income tax on their interest, so therefore we can pay them lower interest because of that. That agreement set a volume capacity limit for all of the Mid-Columbia PUDs. I believe it was $750 million. And once that capacity was used up, once those Mid-C PUDs had borrowed a total of $750 million, there would be no more access to borrow on a tax-exempt basis for hydro capital projects. The reason for that is that much of our capacity and energy generation is actually sold to private parties. So it's what we call private activity. And because of that, the federal government wanted to limit the ability of us to sell power that was generated at a facility that was funded on a tax-exempt basis to parties that were essentially taxable parties like private entities. That volume cap was fully utilized in 2007. And so since 2007, to the extent the district would like to borrow to fund hydro capital projects, we would need to borrow at on a taxable basis. We would not be able to issue those bonds on a tax-exempt basis. So the contracts, knowing that, included that provision that we would assume that we were borrowing on a taxable basis rather than tax-exempt, because in likelihood into the future, that is the bulk of the financing we'd be able to access for hydro capital projects.
That's a follow-up question to that. Knowing that that cap of $750 million was put in over 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Is there any thought or wisdom to looking down the road another 30 years and saying, asking the question, is that still a reasonable limitation?
I think it is a good question. However, the recent tax law changes that went into effect here at the beginning of 2018, we actually, we as in the municipal market, lost the ability to do advanced bond refinancings, which is a tax-exempt market tool that can be used to reduce costs to municipal customers. And there was serious discussion about eliminating private activity bonds in their entirety during that process as well. It's quite possible that in the current environment, it would be difficult to pursue expanding essentially a tax exemption when we're actually seeing and experiencing tax exemption decreases.
Let me add to that if I could. What Heather said is exactly right, but on the other hand, with the change in the House and the Democratic majority that's taken place, and particularly at the Ways and Means Committee, where the chairman now is very familiar with the municipal bond market, at least the large public power council believes there may be an opportunity to revisit both the advance refunding decision and the private use issues. Now, recognizing we're talking about one House, and you still got to get through the Senate and you got to get through the executive branch. But whereas I would have said last year, towards the end of the year, there was little to no hope for visiting those issues, there seems to be a bit more hope now and some more work being done by LPPC to see if the ground could be fertile enough to actually plant some seeds.
I think that's a good point. Also with emphasis on an infrastructure revitalization and spending, particularly around clean power, that might be a good opportunity for the district, because this would be something that would be supportive of maintaining our facilities, improving our facilities, efficiency gains. Go ahead and move on to our finance team. The Asset Liability Management Committee is recommending a two-year capital funding loan from the financing system to the Rock Island system to support those capital projects at the Rock Island system. The reason we're recommending a two-year funding plan really is for administrative efficiency and for certainty of funding. Those projects that were proposing at the Rock Island Capital Plan are multi-year projects, and this provides them some certainty. In addition, the one thing to note about the two-year recommendation is that our current financial forecast model assumes that internal loans will be enacted once per year, so there would be annual funding, and this would be a 2 years of capital funding, so it is a little bit of a mismatch to our current financial forecast model. If the board is supportive of the 2 years of funding, we would, of course, update that projection. But the impacts that that would have is, rather than that funding occurring once in 2019 and once in 2020, it would all occur in 2019. It essentially accelerates that 2020 loan into 2019, and it would the impact would be that a portion of unrestricted cash that we currently are forecasting for 2019 year-end balances would actually be lower because it would pull in that loan. When we do internal loans, we utilize unrestricted cash in the financing system to loan to the Rock Island system. And when we loan it to the Rock Island system due to the power sales contracts, that reclassifies the cash as now a restricted use of cash. It can only be used for capital projects or internal loan retirement. And because of that restriction from an external reporting purpose, we have to include that as restricted cash, not unrestricted cash. So it would have a slight impact to 2019 unrestricted cash balances and days cash on hand metric, but there would be no material impact to the 2020 forecast, and our 2019 balances are very healthy in either situation. We talked a little bit about the power purchaser impacts for the cost plus contracts. Again, they would have a share of annual principal and interest payments, which we would bill monthly. There would also be some contract adders that would increase. As a point of reference, it would be approximately a 4% increase compared to 2018 costs. While the power sales contracts do not require us to notify the purchasers, we believe, especially because this is the first time we've done an internal loan in quite a number of years, and the first time actually under these contracts we've done them at all, we think it would be appropriate to reach out to the purchasers and provide a courtesy notice. That would include the loan schedule as anticipated and note that it's being under consideration and not approved, just to provide them with that notice. So under our proposed loan, the loan terms would actually be set based on the contract by resolution, and that would be considered on March 18th is when we would plan to come back to the board for that consideration. The term, as we discussed, would be 25 years, and the interest rate would be set on the actual issuance date of the loan, which we're proposing to be March 29th. We're estimating that rate currently at about 4.5% based on market conditions at the end of the year. And the loan amount to provide funding for the 2019 and 2020 capital plan that would be in excess of funds that would be available would be $87 million, and that's what the loan amount we would propose would not exceed $87 million. Our timeline would be to provide the next few weeks for commissioner questions and power purchaser outreach, and then returning to the board on March 18th to request consideration and approval of the internal loan resolution. And then on March 29th would actually issue the internal loan to ensure that there's adequate funding for quarter end financial disclosure.
Do we have an estimated rate of return on all of the capital projects at Rock Island, its power sales, loans, interest, and projected rate of return on that?
I don't have that. That's something we can find out and get back to you.
Is that a reasonable request?
I think what we could do is look at the incremental investments that we're making. So we've done analysis on each one of the incremental investments, the Rock Island 5 through 8, 1 through 4, and Rock Island Powerhouse 2. And in fact, was just reviewing that information recently. And so have the opportunity to be able to share that with you in a pretty simple form to show that projects do have different rates of return. Rock Island and Powerhouse 2, very cost effective. Rock Island Powerhouse units 1 through 4, a lot closer, which has been part of our message as we've been discussing the legislative issues, is that the some of these projects are close, and the way that policy evolves in the West will make a difference in terms of their cost effectiveness.
Okay. No, I appreciate that, because it's, you know, we just kind of have that business principle of taking a look at what that is. And again, I would you know, like some information along that line, but I'm not asking for staff to delve into it, you know, in a significant way to consume much of their valuable time, if that makes sense.
Yep. No,
thank
you. We have that available, and we do go through that analysis every time before we come forward with a project, too, and revisit it in the middle of projects, even.
Yeah.
So this is not new work. This is something that we have available to us.
Great. Thank you.
So well, it looks like we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yes. Yep.
Good.
Anything else?
Nope, it's just been a while since we've had a presentation from either or both, and pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any comments from the audience? All right.
Okay, next up we're going to talk about a very important subject. This is the conclusion of the Rock Island Accident Investigation Report. I'm going to invite Kirk and Harold to come on up and get going here. But let me start with a couple of thoughts. So this is the report on the fatality that occurred with respect to Eddie Bromley down at Rock Island back on June 13th. This has clearly been a very traumatic event at the district for employees throughout the district. Management, and it's even impacting employees at other PUDs who worry about what happened here. Let me talk about for a moment about where we are in the process. I'd say that there are really three phases to this process, and we're in have been in phase one. Phase one was our immediate reaction, which was addressing the employee issues and concerns, as well as putting defenses in place to assure that at least that same event couldn't occur again. Phase two was the development of this investigation and bringing it to a conclusion. And with the completion of the investigation, we moved to phase three, which is implementing the recommendations that come out of it. You may wonder why this took so long, because it's been quite a while since June 13th. And I just want to emphasize that we have been committed from the beginning to a comprehensive and thorough analysis. And that meant going wherever it took us, in particular, wherever the independent investigators felt that it needed to go. There have been, Harold will describe the process here, the number of people who have been interviewed, the fact that there were a number of times when we needed to go back and ask more questions. And then late in the process, what we felt was late in the process, new information came to light that actually changed the conclusions of the report and caused us to need to do additional work. So with that, I want to turn it over to Kirk, who will do an introduction, and then we're going to turn it over to Harold Malkin, who is our independent investigator.
Good morning. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Before we turn it over to Harold, I wanted to just try and describe some of the major pieces of equipment, some of the terms that you'll hear, and actually try and put a picture to some of those terms. For those on the phone, I apologize. This is going to be hard, but I'll do my best to describe it. So the first photo here is a aerial photograph of Rock Island Dam. You'll see Powerhouse 1 on the top of the photo, Powerhouse 2 on the bottom of the photo, and the spillway that actually bridges the two powerhouses. I think a few things to point out on this photograph. You'll see what's a very unique design for a spillway on a hydropower project. There's 31 spillway bays that span the two powerhouses. And then from the photograph, you see uniqueness of individual spillway bays. On either side of the river, you see, it's hard to tell just because of the water level, but there's deeper spillway bays on either side of the river, and then shallower spillway bays in between those. You'll also see there's for gates throughout the spillway. Some have to be removed with a gantry crane. Some are equipped with automatic hoists. There's 11 that are equipped with automatic hoists. The gantry cranes, you'll see one here. This is referred to as gantry crane 2 in the report. And this is gantry crane 3, which was used on the day of the accident. Spillway gate 17 is the actual location of the accident. It is normally equipped with an automatic hoist. The time of this photograph and the time of the accident, that hoist had been removed, and so it was not in operation the day of the accident. So the crew was using gantry crane 3 to actually lift the gate. I think that's it for that photograph. So you'll also hear, in this photograph, you'll hear several terms throughout from Harold. One of them that you'll hear most is what's referred to as a swing rail. That's this piece right here, and it's attached to the stanchions of an automatic hoist bay. The purpose of the swing rail is actually to, when you lift a spillway gate, you can only lift it as high as the automatic hoist. So there's two reasons you would actually want to remove that gate. One is if you need to get it out of the way so you can go down and pick up the lower gate. In this particular spillway bay, there's two gates. There's a 22-foot gate and an 11-foot gate. To get the 11-foot gate out, you have to remove the 22. The only way to do it is to actually open up the swing rail. It opens like a door on two hinges, and then you can remove the top 22-foot section and then go down with the crane to get the 11-foot section. The other reason you would remove it is if you were going to do maintenance on the gate itself. So the automatic hoist bays are equipped. They're the only bays that are equipped with the swing rails. The other term you'll hear quite a bit is gantry crane hoist block. That's this piece right here. And it's the piece from the gantry crane that actually goes down and hooks onto the spillway gate itself. There's hooks so that it can be raised and lowered accordingly. And then the final photo is what we refer to as a swing rail hinge pin. And this is this piece right here. And so if you picture a hinge on a door, that pin actually goes into this housing right here. The design of this particular swing rail relies on gravity to actually hold the swing rail in place with that pin in the housing. So with that, I'll turn it over to Harold.
Would you do me one other favor? Yep. And just emphasize the difference between the swing rail and the fixed rail for the audience?
Yeah, so you can barely see it on this photo. At the very bottom, you'll see a gap right here. And that is the separation between the below the gap is a fixed rail, above the gap is the swing rail. The fixed rail is actually anchored into the concrete, so it does not rotate, turn. The swing rail is the piece that actually rotates.
Thank you, everyone, for this opportunity to discuss our report and our findings. Again, my name is Harold Malkin. I'm with the law firm of Lane Powell in Seattle, and welcome your questions as we go or at the end of the briefing. Thought that it would make sense to start with a bit of background regarding Lane Powell's engagement by the district and also sort of the nuts and bolts of the process that we followed to conduct our investigation of the June 13th incident. The district hired Lane Powell within days, I think it was 4 days, of the June 13th fatality incident involving Mr. Bromley to conduct an independent internal investigation of the cause of that incident. Lane Powell has in the past, as you may know, done work on behalf of the district, but I personally had never been involved in any of that work. By way of personal background, just to give you a sense of the experience that I bring to a task like this, before I joined Lane Powell in April of 2016, I spent approximately 20 years with the United States Department of Justice, both in Washington, D.C., and then as an assistant U.S. attorney in Seattle, where it was my job to conduct investigations of various types on behalf of the Department of Justice. So a task like this fits well within my experience. Currently, I chair Lane Powell's Investigations, Compliance, and White Collar Practice Group, and in that capacity, routinely conduct these sorts of complex, sensitive investigations for firm clients when the need arises. When we were engaged by the district, we were given only three instructions. One was to conduct a thorough and comprehensive investigation of the incident. The second was to identify all issues of concern related to the incident that we discovered. And the third one was to be completely candid regarding our investigative findings and our advice to the district, including any recommendations that we developed to avoid a recurrence of the incident. It was clear to us that the primary objective of the investigation, as far as the district was concerned, was to learn everything possible from the incident. And as such, because we are lawyers, we retained two different consultants to help us approach the investigation from different perspectives to ensure a multifaceted analysis of the events that led up to and that caused the incident. Specifically in that regard, we retained Tetra Tech, which is an international engineering firm with particular expertise in dam design and construction, to assess the technical and physical aspects of the incident. We also retained WD Associates, which is a firm with expertise in human performance improvement, what you'll hear me refer to as HPI, to help us assess the organizational and human elements that may have contributed to the incident. And then finally, to ensure our own independence as part of this process, we and our consultants insisted upon final editorial control over the content of our respective reports. We wanted it to be clear, and there was no pushback from the district whatsoever, that the content of our reports would reflect our own judgment and conclusions, and we were not going to be swayed by suggestions other than reasonable suggestions about the content of our reports. What did our investigation actually, what was it comprised of? We made three site visits, investigative site visits, to Rock Island and to the district. We conducted 25 investigative interviews plus numerous follow-up interviews, which included interviews of district personnel with more than 25 years experience in and around Rock Island. Approximately 60 hours of time spent interviewing and re-interviewing knowledgeable folks. We conducted an extensive review and analysis of historical records and reports, including safety, maintenance, and operational reports. We looked at and studied design drawings, relevant photographs from before and after the incident, and also relevant internal communications, email communications, about Gate 17, about the topic of swing rails from both before and after the incident. And of course, we worked closely and consulted with our experts and had the opportunity to review their reports and their analysis before finalizing our own report. We were the ones who determined which employees of the district we should interview, and we were the ones who determined what documents were relevant to our investigation. There were times when, because we did not have the familiarity with certain subject areas, that we would ask the district for their input as to whether someone would be a good candidate for an interview or whether documents existed and would be relevant to our investigation. We got input from the district, but the final decision was our own. The investigative team was provided complete and total site access, as well as prompt access to everyone we requested and all documentary materials that we requested. Steve mentioned the time that it's taken us to get this far, given the fact that the incident took place in June. I would attribute that to scheduling coordination amongst investigative team members, our law firm, our engineering consultant, our HPI consultant, particularly HPI consultant who is not from the Seattle area, necessary technical analysis, follow-up interviews that I mentioned to make sure that we understood the information that we were receiving and that we could confirm its accuracy, and most of all, our desire to be thorough and comprehensive, resulted in a fact-finding and report-drafting process that took us until approximately early December, when, as Steve mentioned, We had additional information brought to our attention that I'll comment on momentarily that required renewed search for historical records, as well as additional interviews, analysis, and redrafting of our report. In our judgment, all of the individuals that we interviewed were candid and forthcoming in response to all of our questions, which facilitated, from our perspective, a thorough and objective investigation of the June 13th incident. And then my last comment before I get into our findings, just want to make sure everyone here understands that my comments today are meant to summarize Lane Powell's 29-page report to the district, which both incorporates and separately includes the multi-page reports of both of our subject matter experts. The board has received our report, and it's my understanding that the district intends, as early perhaps as this afternoon, to post that report publicly on its website, redacted only to a very limited extent to protect the privacy of participants, both in the investigation and in the incident itself. Much greater detail, as I think the board has seen for itself, much greater detail concerning our investigation, the incident, our findings, and our recommendations to the district are present in our report, and I would certainly commend to the audience that they look at the report and its attachments in their entirety and not accept today's briefing as a conclusive summary of all of our work. Now, what were our findings? In summary, there were two findings about the principal causes of the June 13th incident. The first is an inherent and, in recent years, unrecognized weakness in the design of the swing rails deployed, as Kirk mentioned, at 11 of Rock Island's 31 spillway bays, including Gate 17, where Mr. Bromley was struck and killed. The second finding, the second cause, is the district's failure to promptly and formally document and adequately address swing rail-related safety concerns, which credible and recently identified evidence suggests were first raised back in the mid-1990s, shortly after swing rails were added at Rock Island for the very first time. And let me back up and cover each of those separately. And again, welcome your questions. With respect to the design weakness, finding number one, the design weakness we identified fails to prevent the swing rail from inadvertently lifting vertically and virtually silently out of the housing that attaches it to the spillway infrastructure, allowing the swing rail to become detached from the spillway bay and to fall to the spillway deck, as occurred on June 13th. And I think you saw Kirk make reference to that hinge assembly where the pin drops into a cylinder and where gravity is the force that keeps it or is supposed to keep it in place. That, for reasons that I'll get to in a moment, didn't happen on June 13th. Immediately following the June 13th incident, the district took a number of immediate interim measures to address this design weakness and to mitigate the potential risk it posed to worker safety. Implementation of permanent measures are presently under active consideration. You'll hear about those. Despite persistent and diligent efforts to locate documentary or other conclusive evidence, we were unable to determine whether the swing rail design originated within or outside the district. We looked for documentation as to what the origin of that particular design was. Was it something that was conceived of in-house? Was it something that was farmed out to an engineering firm or to a vendor? And simply were not able to conclusively come up with an answer to that question. Now, with respect to the second finding, having to do with previously raised swing rail concerns, although we identified credible evidence that safety concerns about the swing rail's design were first raised back in the mid-1990s by an employee assigned to Rock Island, not all Rock Island personnel working on or among swing rails at that time were apprised of or made aware of the potential risk that they posed. In any event, despite those concerns having been raised roughly two decades ago, no contemporaneous written documentation of any concerns was recorded at that time in the mid-1990s. Secondly, no service request was submitted by anyone aware of the concerns back at that time to address them. And thirdly, no written operational procedure was adopted by the district to address and mitigate those concerns on a prospective or going forward basis. Instead, information regarding potential swing rail safety concerns was disseminated only informally via verbal means among some Rock Island personnel. Due to retirements, departures, and reassignments, continued and ongoing dissemination of information about the potential risk posed by the swing rail design ceased sometime prior to the June 13th incident, obviously with tragic consequences. It's important to note that current district policies and procedures, which were implemented since the 1990s, but prior and unrelated to the June 13th incident, require that similar types of safety concerns be promptly reported, documented, investigated, and when deemed appropriate, promptly addressed. Now, a couple additional observations I'd like to make before I get to our recommendations. First, just to underscore, until new and credible information recently came to our attention that swing rail-related safety concerns were first raised back in the 1990s, no one that we interviewed as part of our investigation that was involved in any facet of the June 13th test lift of Gate 17 had reported to us ever themselves having concerns about the safety of swing rails or ever previously having been made aware directly or indirectly of concerns that other of their colleagues may have had about swing rail safety. Second, we were not able to pinpoint definitively the precise mechanical cause of the swing rail lifting, becoming detached and falling as it did on June 13th. As you may know, there's not regular sort of video taken and focused on these particular gates or during operations such as took place on June 13th. And none of the eyewitnesses, none of the crew members who were actually involved in that test lift on June 13th were focused on that particular area that Kirk highlighted. Their focus and attention at that moment was focused downwards into the gate slot because they'd been asked to check by the control room on whether or not those lower gates, that those segments, gate segments that Kirk mentioned, had been engaged and were beginning to lift. So they were looking down at the time, not up, and therefore the eyewitnesses were not focused exactly on the point where we believe this took place. Nevertheless, our investigation and accompanying technical analysis performed by our engineering consultant concluded, and I'm going to, I think, walk you through in a moment exactly what I'm about to say, but I want to read it first and then step back and show you a depiction of it. Nevertheless, our engineering consultant concluded that the most probable explanation for the swing rail becoming dislodged was a slight rotation of Gantry Crane 3's north hoist block as the block began to lift after engaging Gate 17's north hook. This in turn caused the hoist block's leaders to catch what is believed to have been a slightly misaligned bottom edge of Gate 17's north swing rail, lifting the rail until it became dislodged from its upper and lower hinge assemblies, fell, and mortally wounded Mr. Bromley. Now that's a mouthful, I realize, so let me step back and try and depict that. Rebecca, if you wouldn't mind. So again, let me just highlight for you the things to keep in mind. If you see my pointer, Kirk mentioned the hoist block and the swing rail with the fixed rail below it and the little gap that exists there, the cut and the hinge pin. And what I was trying to describe, and I hope when I turn you'll be able to hear me, but what I was trying to explain was, you see here the lower portion is the fixed rail, the upper portion is the swing rail. Our engineering consultant, when he went out onto the spillway to conduct an inspection, found that there was a bit of horizontal misalignment
between the fixed portion of the rail and the swing rail portion of the rail, you can see that the swing rail portion of the rail juts out just ever so slightly forward from the fixed rail portion. We refer to that as horizontal misalignment. And at various places along the swing rail, our consultant measured anything from 1/16 to 3/16 of an inch horizontal misalignment. And what ended up happening was, as the hoist block begins to engage the hook at the top of gate 17 and begin to lift it, what I referred to as the leader down here, which you can see actually pushes against the fixed rail and will continue as it rides upwards and is lifted to push against the swing rail. In the next picture, here's the leader. You see the top edge of the leader just engage slightly the bottom misaligned edge of the swing rail. And as the hoist block continues to lift gate 17 in this instance, in the third slide, you see how the leader continues as it is lifted forward to catch and lift the bottom edge of the swing rail. The effect of that, if you go back here, is that the swing rail continues to push up. That pin that Kirk mentioned depends on gravity to remain in place, rises out of its cylinder, and once that happens, the swing rail can fall completely away from the spillway bay, and as happened on June 13th, fall to the deck, and unfortunately, in this instance, tragically, in this instance, strike and kill Mr. Bromley. So hopefully that puts in context those words, which I know are difficult to comprehend in the abstract. One other observation, it's noteworthy that there was a significant equipment failure at Spillway Bay 17 back in March of 2017, which necessitated, as Kirk mentioned earlier, the fixed hoist that normally would be on top of Spillway Bay 17. The fixed hoist was removed. The bay was thoroughly inspected for damage, repaired, inspected again, and gate 17 was test lifted by a gantry crane, not gantry crane 3, which was involved in this incident, but gantry crane 2, without reported incident before it was returned to service in August of 2017. Similarly, on May 11th, 2018, a month and 2 days prior to the June 13th incident, Gate 17 was the subject of a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission required test lift, which again was undertaken by a gantry crane, gantry crane 2, and was again completed without concern of any type having been noted by the crew. The point of this is that neither of those relatively recent events identified a potential problem using a gantry crane, albeit a different gantry crane than was used on June 13th, using a gantry crane to lift a gate outfitted with a swing rail. Now, fourth and finally, let me get to the recommendations. At our direction and consistent with the district's instruction to us, both our engineering and HPI consultants separately assessed whether relevant district policies, practices, and/or procedures should be modified prospectively in a manner to enhance operational safety at Rock Island Dam. A final and all-inclusive table of our consultants' affirmative recommendations and separately recommendations for district consideration appears on pages 22 through 28 of our report. All of the consultants' recommendations are contained there. And again, just underscore, there are affirmative recommendations that our consultants urge the district to undertake, and then there are others that are proposed for district consideration. With respect to the affirmative recommendations, our consultants concluded that there were three, as I mentioned. One, the district should adopt, and apply certain U.S. Army Corps of Engineers inspection and design guidance to the Rock Island spillway bays and gantry crane hoist blocks. The second one is that the district should adopt additional procedures for dam operations using gantry cranes in an effort to improve risk awareness and behavior mitigation associated with such operations. And the third of the affirmative recommendations is that the district should conduct an independent survey
to ensure that potential safety concerns are promptly and formally documented, and where necessary, appropriate training and operational procedures are adopted and institutionalized in response. Now, there were a number of proposed recommendations for district consideration. The three principal ones, and the others appear in our report, are that the district should consider, number one, modifying gantry crane 3 to allow it to better tolerate that slight misalignment that I referenced between fixed and swing rails while engaged in lifting operations. The second one is to consider complete elimination of swing rails on the spillway. And the third and final one that I comment on here is specific changes that are outlined in the HPI report, specific changes to the district's current job planning, processes, and procedures. And you'll hear in a moment from Dan Garrison with respect to what the district's response to those various recommendations has been and will be. But finally, Lane Powell's report considered the affirmative recommendations as well as the recommendations that were proposed for consideration by the district. And our report, recommends and urges the district to adopt each of the affirmative recommendations and to seriously consider adopting the suggested modifications to district engineering, operational, and written procedures. So with that summary, and again, commending to your attention and the attention of the audience, the posted report that is much more detailed, goes into much greater detail about the history of the spillway, the installation originally of the swing rails, and what various people told us during our investigation, although without disclosing their identities. That completes the summary of our findings. I'd be happy to take any questions. I know it's a lot of information, so as you reflect on what you've heard or possibly what you've read, certainly we're available through Steve or his colleagues to answer questions that may occur to you later. But anything that may have occurred to you already, I'm happy to try and answer. Okay. Anyone not present on the phone have a question? Okay, well, thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you for your presentation. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harold. Next up, so there are a set of recommendations and then recommendations for consideration that Harold has described here. What we want to do is walk through management reaction to that. We've got Kirk Hudson, Dan Garrison, and Tim Pettit who have been managing this. I think we're going to start with Dan.
I'll just briefly make a comment in regards to the recommendations that Harold outlined, and that is that for the affirmative recommendations, we are faithfully implementing each of the affirmative recommendations, and then for the suggestions, we're committing to evaluate each of the suggestions as well. And with that, I'll let Dan and Tim go through those recommendations.
Thanks, Kirk. So I have my comments divided into two sections. The first are the recommendations from Petra Tech and WD Associates. The second part will be the considerations also from Petra Tech and WD Associates. There will be a point where I will pass off to Tim as the recommendations or considerations are more applicable to his Department of Human Performance than they are in mine. In the report, you'll see, as Harold mentioned, a list of a table of all of the various recommendations. And for completeness, I'll go through each and every one and our management response to those recommendations. The first one from Tector Tech is to inspect all spillways and spill bays with swing rails. Yes, we are committed to measuring key rail dimensions, inspecting spill gate wheels and bumpers, and inspecting gantry crane rollers. For work that's not already part of pre-existing preventive maintenance tasks, We will develop new inspection plans and schedule those appropriately. The second recommendation from Tetra Tech is to revise swing rail and stanchion designs to withstand hoist capacity. This is a recommendation coming out of the U.S. Corps of Engineers for Hydraulic Steel Structures. Yes, we are committed to limiting the hoists so that a structural failure such as observed on June 13th does not occur again. We will do this by the installation of limit switches. We had Tetra Tech review this application, and it was approved to satisfy this recommendation. A second part of this recommendation is to commit to periodic inspection of all spillway structures as recommended by the technical documents of the Corps of Engineers and define them as hydraulic steel structures. Yes, we are committed to perform those inspections. The third part of this recommendation, yes, we are also committed to specifying acceptable rail tolerances on prints and our inspection sheets. The third recommendation from Tetra Tech is to review and analyze any proposed structural modifications with respect to the Corps of Engineers hydraulic steel structures. Yes, we are committed to this design criteria for current and future structural modifications of spillway structures. Of the specific bullets that were mentioned in the reports, and I'll identify those, there were two specific modifications listed. One was to apply a structural bolt to hold the rail in place and or add a splice plate between the fixed rails and the swing rails. After review, they do not meet the design criteria, or they created other operational concerns, and they will not be considered any further.
The splice plate? Is that...
Splice plate. So, just for clarity, thank you, Kirk. Kirk mentioned this is the fixed rail down here. This is the swing rail. There would actually be a splice plate across that gap bolted in place that would not allow it to move. That does cause other operational concerns, and we do have one location with that in place, and we will be removing that. What we are doing currently is adding hold-down gusset plates to the swing rails. This was analyzed in regard to the requirements of the Corps of Engineers and in combination of limit switches that satisfies the requirements for hydraulic steel structures. And so specifically what we're doing with this limit switch is if there is any vertical movement of those swing rails, the power to the hoist would be shut off and it would not allow any further vertical movement. Lastly, for this recommendation, we have posted warning signs. They're already in place. There's a sign located at each swing rail that instructs the maintenance crews that if the spill gate must be removed, with the gantry crane there to open up those swing rails and remove that hazard. The first recommendation from WD Associates is to establish procedures for bridge and gantry cranes to establish safe zones, to restrict access, and to provide a crew member dedicated to maintaining an overall perspective of the lift. Yes, the district is committed to establishing these procedures for all station cranes. Procedures for restricting access and establishing safe zones are complete and in practice for all lifting activity associated with Rock Island Spillway. This recommendation will go beyond Rock Island, and we will be looking at all station cranes, including Rocky Reach and Chelan and other cranes throughout the district. For the second WD, I'll turn to Tim.
Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and Human Performance. Under this, they have recommended to conduct an independent survey or assessment of Chelan County PUD personnel at all facilities for these purposes, and there will be three purposes here. One is to determine the degree of employee awareness and engagement of our IRS reporting system, and that is our incident reporting and investigative standard that we have in place now. Two is to assess the frequency with which employees currently document safety concerns, which is also a program that we now have in place. And three is to perform a data review of our IRS concerns to ensure that appropriate actions are taken by the district to resolve institutionalized similar safety concerns. The answers to those three are yes, the district is committed to determining the degree of awareness and engagement of the incident reporting and investigation standard. Yes, the district is committed to assessing the frequency with which employees currently document safety concerns. And yes, the district will perform data reviews of IRS concerns to ensure the appropriate actions have been taken by the district to resolve the institutionalized similar safety concerns. There's two purposes for that. One is to see if what we have in place has the strength that we would have caught this, documented it, and repaired this had we had these in place in the 90s. The others is, do the processes we have in place today possess the strength that the district desires for their commitment to safety in the future?
So those are the recommendations. Unless there's a question, I'll go into the considerations. First consideration from Tetra Tech is to modify the crane block leader to allow them to cross the travel across the rail gaps with slight misalignment. I believe Harold and or Kirk showed how the, and I think it's behind me, how that the leader block could be modified to provide a greater capability of crossing that gap without catching onto the swing rail. We are committed to reviewing possible corrections for that and implementing it. The second consideration is to eliminate the need for swing rails entirely from Rock Island Dam. Yes, we are committed to reviewing options for removing swing rails from the spillway. Currently, we do have a feasibility study in progress for the modernization of Rock Island Spillway. All the options that are listed in the Lane Powell report and Tetra Tech report will be submitted to the feasibility team and considered as part of that project.
Gary or Randy, are there any questions?
Thank you, Steve. No, I'm just taking it all in. Thank you.
Same here, Steve. It's a very, very comprehensive report.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'd like to finish with a couple of thoughts. Try to summarize what we've heard and what we're going to do about it. So I would start with, there was, for the most part, a latent and unrecognized weakness in the original design of the spillway lifting mechanism that led to this tragedy. There is credible evidence that at least one district employee identified the weakness in the 1990s, and that did create an opportunity to mitigate the weakness either through redesign or operational procedures. We can find no evidence that there was an effort to implement a redesign fix. There were some operational procedures put in place, and unfortunately, due to the district practice of that time of not documenting safety concerns, they were lost and not in place in 2018. Importantly, I think the employees on the spillway deck and the Rock Island Hydro Project managers in 2018 had no knowledge of the risk or potential mitigation practices and acted appropriately based on their knowledge. Since June 13th, we've taken action to implement interim design changes and new operational procedures that reduce the risk of a similar incident. So we feel reasonably confident today that the same thing could not happen again. But I would call those interim fixes. There are many recommendations in this report that can reduce risk. We are actively implementing the affirmative recommendations and considering those that were recommended for additional evaluation. I would add importantly that we are also thinking about this not just in terms of hydro system operations out at Rock Island, but more generally, what can we learn from this that will help us in terms of procedures across the district, certainly with respect to things like pre-task planning and making sure that we do document safety concerns. There are opportunities here for us to learn and think about it from an entire district-wide perspective. I will say that I am heartened by one thing, at least, in this report, and that is that we have a basis for operating and making changes that I think are likely to be effective. And I would refer you to a sentence in the second paragraph of this report that said, "The clear and overwhelming consensus of the individuals we interviewed was the district has worked diligently to implement and enforce an appropriate culture of safety, free from fear of retaliation, governing daily operations at Rock Island." Everyone here had the chance to be able to speak to the independent investigator and speak from their heart about what they thought was going on. And I think I at least feel heartened by the fact that our employees believe that they have the ability to speak out if they perceive there to be a safety concern, and that our challenge now is to make sure that we learn from this and become better. We can't take back June 13th as much as we would like to. We can honor Eddie Bromley by learning and acting on what we have learned from this investigation. And I can tell you that we are committed to the mission of making the PUD a safer place to work.
It's a very sobering note to end on. And I just, on behalf of the commissioners, I would like to thank our investigative team for the thoroughness of the investigation, staff for the ongoing work, Steve, the administration, everybody's dedication to learn from this tragic incident and to get better in the future. That's what we're about. And I think the words of honoring Eddie are important, that all of that work is what this is truly about, honoring him and preventing as the best that we possibly can as human beings to avoid these tragic situations in the future. So I just want to thank all of you for that work.
If I could finish with one thought, I do want to particularly call out Tracy Yunt. Pretty much everybody that worked on this, it was part of their job to do that. For Tracy, we pulled him out of activity, his regular activity, and he did a tremendous amount of work helping to pull together all the right people, making sure that logistically we were able to get through it. And I just am grateful for his efforts. So, Tracy, thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank all of you. Appreciate it.
This is the end of our work session agenda. Should we go ahead and move into the consent agenda and manager's report?
We have some manager's items, and we could use right now. We've got folks that are ready to present if it's okay with the commission. I want to start with Justin Erickson, who'll come up and talk about strategic planning and topic team updates. Go ahead and invite Mike Holman to come up too. He's going to talk about the first topic team meeting.
Harold, thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I'd like to start with a brief update regarding our overall strategic planning process. The topic team work is now underway, and you'll hear updates this morning from several of us related to our particular teams. We have noticed a spike in website activity on our dedicated strategic planning website since the kickoff event and since some of the additional public outreach and notice that we provided. And so that's been encouraging that the community is engaged. Also, our first video content has, I believe, been well received as well. So we did that video that you saw at the kickoff event also in a Spanish version. The English version to date has had has reached a little over 8,000 individuals. The Spanish version, a little over 5,000. Of those, almost 5,000 have viewed at least the first 3 seconds of the English version and about 2,500 the first 3 seconds of the Spanish version. So we're encouraged by those results and look forward to incorporating additional digital video content to engage the public going forward. Over the next 60 days, topic teams will continue to meet and do the bulk of their work and work through their strategic topics and their specific questions. And this will then facilitate the all customer owner outreach that is scheduled to occur in May. And as part of that outreach, you will then see additional notifications related to meetings and outreach opportunities and additional engagement focus so that we can really elicit those responses from customer owners and hopefully validate the work that's been done through the topic process. Any questions on where we're at?
Does it seem to be anything that's trending in terms of our feedback?
Excellent question.
And you don't have to answer that now if you want to massage that question a little. Then.
I will. I think I probably can answer that question a little bit better in a couple of weeks as every topic team meets for a second time or since the kickoff event.
Okay.
But I'll certainly keep that on the forefront of my mind. Thank you.
Yeah. Wind direction is always important.
Yes. All right. I'm just going to switch gears now to talk about my topic team specifically, which is the Rock Island Relicensing and Early Action Topic Team. Our first meeting after the kickoff event is scheduled for this Thursday, March 7th at 1 p.m. We do have several new participants that have been identified. Those participants may have been in another breakout event on the kickoff event. And so what we plan to do for this Thursday's meeting is to provide a briefer presentation, a condensed version of what we presented on February 7th to the group. And just a reminder for you of current participants in our team, this includes the City of Wenatchee, City of Rock Island, Audubon Society, the Land Trust, Malaga Community Council, Washington State Parks, and the County Commission. So a good diverse group, and we look forward to the upcoming meeting. We don't anticipate a lot of presentation materials or things to show you in advance. What we anticipate doing with the group on Thursday is to do several brainstorming activities. So we'll go through the pros and cons of pursuing early action, get feedback from the participants. We'll also look at evaluation criteria. We have some criteria that staff's drafted, but we also want to test that with the group. And they also may identify other criteria that we need to consider. And then lastly, we'll talk about potential early actions, hear from each of the participants about specific actions or projects that they want to talk about and that they would like to be considered. So that is where we're at specifically on that topic team. Be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Commissioners, Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications, and I'm facilitating the Public Power Benefit Topic Team. I did have my first meeting last week on the 28th of February. The PPB Topic Team, of course, covers a very, very broad series of activities, but we went into it with four questions. One of those was, should Chelan PUD continue to fund a public power benefit program? And within that, we looked at the current method or criteria of funding and said, should we reevaluate that criteria? The third question goes to, what activities should be considered for funding? And lastly, the question is, how should these activities be prioritized? So my first topic team was also a victim of the weather. It snowed pretty heavy the night before. We also had a number of individuals that had conflicts because they had activities going on in Olympia. However, we did get five folks there, and they were very dedicated, and I have a commitment to the rest of the team to summarize the meeting, summarize the discussion, and then cover it with them individually for their input. Eric attended the meeting and covered the issue of nexus and authority, what we could do both under our express and our implied authorities. Kelly attended and provided a overview of the financial, both the previous planning period financials versus the picture that we have in front of us today. And she also covered the methodology that was used for the criteria for funding last time. So after we took our break, and Kelly and Eric were gone, I asked the team specifically how they felt about what they had heard to that point. And the response was overwhelming that it was an educational opportunity for them, both on the financial side and the authority side. Kevin Powers, one of the members from the Leavenworth area, spoke up and made a rather astute observation, in my opinion. He talked about the ability to actually hear that and the educational aspect of it, but he commented on the fact that the district has a very large challenge in communicating those particular issues to the public at large. They are complex issues, they're big issues, and therefore it was a challenge to be able to communicate that in a manner that the public overall would understand and particularly be able to put some context around the decisions that come out of this. So to that end, after the meeting, we did talk and particularly talked about ways that we could help communicate that particular aspect of our business. And we're going to work on some sort of a visual or graphic illustration to better understand the authority issue and what can and cannot be considered under PPB. When we address the two primary questions for this topic team, should the PUD continue the public power benefit program, there was overwhelming support for that. The comments in general talked about the fact that the public power benefit program provides solid continuing value for the communities, and they very much want to see it continue. When we talked about the criteria for funding, there was an acknowledgement that, yes, given the changing circumstances, they would recommend that we reevaluate the criteria for funding, but also that's a very knowledge-based activity. And while they would like to see it examined and potentially changed, they also realize that many of the subject matter experts from within the staff need to be the ones that ultimately say, what should the new criteria be? And so we'll run that back by the team as we get it developed and get their response to it. I was going to tell you that my next meetings will be on March 14th and March 28th, and they probably will be, but I offered the team the opportunity to give me feedback and say, would they rather meet in the morning or meet in the afternoon? And so we're going to do a doodle poll and let the majority rule on that. Once we have that, we'll update the outreach calendar so everybody knows when the next two meetings will be. So it was a very productive. I enjoyed the session and particularly enjoyed the engagement of the members that were there because they were thoroughly engaged.
How many people on your committee total, if you have on your list anyway?
If I say 12 right now, it may change in about 30 minutes. Okay. We have had a lot of folks that expressed interest, and then when I talk to them and say, this is not a forum for advocating for your project, it's a forum for setting the boundaries around the projects that are going to be selected. Some people wanted to disengage at that point. And I think it goes to that difficulty of understanding the authority issue. I have had a lot of input, both from potential team members as well as others, and many of the requests are for things that are going to be a real problem with our authority. So we still have that to work through.
And I'm always reminded that when we do a communication plan that you've got 2 minutes in an aisle at Albertsons and you're speaking with an eighth grader. Mm-hmm. So as we refine that package or whatever it is, it's got to be really short, simple, sweet, clear. And you take complex issues and reduce them down to a simple dynamic. We have to select carefully. So thank you. I know there's a sensitivity to that, but yeah. I just feel as a commissioner, I know that's just kind of the role that we end up in. And it's an elevator opportunity. And mm-hmm. It's just interesting feedback in passing that's fairly effective. Mm-hmm. So cartoon version.
Well, we'll see what turns out.
Slightly above that, I would hope. Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly.
I want to invite John Stoll to come up. Maybe have Andy come up too, since we'll move into that one next. So we have two items. John's going to start with an update from his work on strategic planning.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. In line with the strategic planning, there's a couple of the questions around aesthetics as well as economic development. So this week we will be launching a survey conducted by Cocker Fennessy out of Seattle. We've worked with them over the past 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, developing a survey. They're very highly regarded. They've done a number of projects. This one will, again, to address the aesthetic issue, basically trying to understand the trade-offs between rates and aesthetics, as well as economic development questions. So it's really kind of split into two, again, to answer those two questions as part of strategic planning, at least help inform the group as we move forward. So I believe Thursday it starts, and it will begin with a email from Steve to the, I think, roughly 25,000 emails that we have on file, just letting them know that a survey will be starting, and they may be called or sent a link to a survey. They've identified a 600 population sample size to be generalizable, scientifically valid. This will cover the wide variety of geographic regions. It will look at both primary residents as well as folks who may have second homes. It will be in both Spanish and English. Anticipate probably 2 to 3 weeks for the field work to continue. It will come out in waves, so you know they'll try and target these areas to get the demographic mix to again reach a sample size of 600. Expect that to conclude in March, and then I think about mid-April, Cocker Fennessy will come back and give a presentation on the results. As part of the rates group topic team, this will be helpful with that group as we start holding our meetings in April as well.
If there are no questions about that, we'll jump over to Andy, who's going to give you an update on the outreach on Chelant Substation.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service. As you know, the PUD is committed to involving the community in times that we are siting substations and transmission lines. And so as a result, as you know, we've brought forward the last few months planning models that show the PUD needs to build a new substation in the vicinity of the Chelan Dam area in, near the city of Chelan. And so we are actively soliciting community input on that. We've scheduled two forums on March 13th, coming up, that's next week. We've scheduled a community stakeholders meeting. It's a luncheon held at Campbell's where we'll be soliciting input on what our models are telling us and some ideas about maybe concerns the community would have from anywhere from aesthetics or any other issues they may have with that substation siting. In addition, that evening at that afternoon at 3:30 to 5:30, we're having what we call a drop-in. This is at the Chamber of Commerce in Chelan, where anybody in the public can come by and meet with us and ask questions, provide feedback to us on the substation. In addition to the substation, you heard late last fall, the transmission group brought in a recommendation to do some rebuilding of our existing transmission line in that area. So this outreach effort really at the luncheon as well as at the Chamber of Commerce later on is twofold, not only to talk about the substation, but in addition, the transmission line rebuild. So we'll be soliciting customer feedback on that as well.
Andy, just a suggestion on dates. You know, I plan on being at the March 13th.
Excellent.
But that's in direct conflict with the State Association meeting that day. And so my suggestion would be is that if possible to check ahead and see if we're going to eliminate commissioner participation based on conflict of schedule.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Would like to try to slip at least one more in, maybe two. We'll see.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Going to come up and provide an update on Lake Chelan and particularly how we plan reservoir operations when you've got a below average water year forecast.
Commissioners, John Wasniewski with the Energy Planning and Trading Group. As Steve mentioned, I'll give a quick update on Lake Chelan and a specific focus on operating the lake in below average water years. Quick look at the agenda. I think the seven operating objectives are a good place to start a discussion about Lake Chelan. Anytime we talk about the lake, this is really the guidelines we use to make decisions. And I won't dig into each individual objective, but I will highlight the first two, as the first two objectives have priority over lake levels. The first one is maintaining minimum flows in the Chelan River, which is 80 CFS, and the second one is reducing high flows in the Chelan River, which we try to keep below 6,000 CFS. And again, those two objectives have priority over the other objectives. When managing lake levels, and based on the seven operating objectives, it's not always a clear decision. Many of the objectives compete with each other. So that's kind of the intent of this slide, is just to show that there are, it is kind of a balancing act when it comes to making decisions. And I also wanted to highlight that we do have a lake level management team that meets monthly to assist with this decision-making process. And there's representatives from the Hydro Operations Group, License and Compliance, Fish and Wildlife, Transmission, Communications, Power Marketing. And so, these decisions aren't made in isolation, but with many different groups that are impacted. I'll have a say. Now, focusing on operations during dry water years, which looks to be kind of where we are this year or below average water, how that impacts the way we operate the lake is the first thing is there are two different target curves, one built for dry and average water years and one for wet water years. So the first thing we do, as you can see, here's a snapshot from this year is we follow that target curve for dry and average year, so we don't draft the lake quite as deep. Second thing is to reduce the number of water years we use in our modeling. We have a set of 89 historical water years we use to model potential outcomes when we look at making decisions for the lake. So as we reduce that water set, you'll see the orange band here kind of dwindle down a little bit. So right now we're modeling about 40 water years that range from 60% of average to 100% of average. And that will just help us help guide our decisions. And the third thing is really when we receive inflows into the lake, it'll go one of three places. It'll either be kept in the lake to refill, it'll be pushed through the powerhouse to generate power electricity, or it will be spilled into the Chelan River. So as we get into below average water years, the one thing that we keep constant is we make sure that lake is refilled. That's the priority. And then any extra water we'll use to generate anything further than that We'll go, you know, spilling for headwater control to make sure we don't go over our license maximum. And I'll also highlight that when we talk about refilling the lake, I know that gets to be a concern in below average water years. Kind of two key numbers I'll talk about as we move forward are the refill date of July 1. So the lake is considered full at 1,098 feet, not at 1,100 feet, which is something that we always are trying to educate folks on. So 1,098 feet and on July 1. So our water supply forecasts are from April 1 to July 31st, so that four-month period. And since we try to refill the lake by July 1 for that target elevation, we bring in an element of timing, so not only the volume of water, but also the timing of when we receive that water. So if we do have the lake, the lowest point typically on March 31st here, it takes about 13 feet of water to meet minimum spill requirements and get the lake to 1,098 feet by July 1st. The current water year, our February 1 forecast was for 80%. Actually, was out on a snow survey Friday, and I'm still working on gathering some data to put out our March 1st forecast, but it looks like it'll be quite similar, pretty close to 77% of average. So real similar to that 80% number. And the graphic here shows, again, this year, with that forecasted water amount, the red down here is that 80 CFS min spill, about a half a foot of water. And then the water needed to fill the lake by July 1 is 12 and a half feet of water. And again, with 80% of average water here, again, we're expecting a little bit less now with the most recent update, but there's still a fair amount of water left for generation and or spill. And then the total amount of water, this is July 1 again to refill the lake, and then July 31st to account for the whole water supply forecast. And kind of the next natural question that we've discussed is if 80% or, you know, 75-77% is within our normal operations and we're not concerned about refilling the lake, you know, at what point does that become a concern, or at what point does water supply become so low that we start to have issues with refilling the lake? And that's what the next slide is meant to answer. So I kind of started looking at different water years and making sure, again, we had that 13 feet of water by July 1st to refill the lake on time. So I started with 60%, and I looked at both average runoff timing and late runoff timing. Again, both there's enough water there to refill the lake as well as to continue to generate electricity. At 55%, similar outcome. And really when we get down to about a 50% of average water year, that's when we start to get below that 13 feet of water needed to refill the lake. And also important to point out is it's very rare that situation might occur, really anything less than a 60% of average water year. It's only occurred three times in all 89 years of historical data that we have. So again, this just goes to illustrate that being fairly close to 80% of water supply, again, it's a forecasted number. It can certainly still change, but that, you know, at this point is not alarming to us. And here's a summary of some key points. One thing I'll touch on a little more, as I know I've gotten a lot of questions about all the snow in the valley here. And folks think it's a you know, maybe a above average water year, and they're surprised to hear that we're closer to 80% of average in the Lake Chelan Basin. And I've been surprised as well. You know, as I come in the mornings, I'll get a lot of snow, and I'll look at the snowtell sites up in the basin, and I won't quite see the snow up there I would expect. And I think that's just kind of the nature of the way that the weather and the storms have come in and the way they've distributed snow. And a lot of it has come from the south and hasn't reached as far north as you know, Stehekin and a lot of the Lake Chelan Basin. Be happy
it's
to answer
all hiding in my yard. Right. 3 feet deep. And
yeah. I'm getting tired of it.
Yeah, historically, it was always kind of interesting when I first became a commissioner, because we'd have some little bit lower water years here in the valley, and people would point up at Mission Ridge and say, well, look at the snow right there. It's like, well, how many of our dams does that snow pass? Oh, you know, just the realization of where that snow falls and where it drains.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. Snow quality doesn't have much to do with us.
So I just add, we know Memorial Day is always an issue, and that's more uncertain and more challenging, really more dependent on just how much water and snow shows up, right, John?
That's right. The further, you know, closer to winter we come, so earlier in the spring, the more timing becomes an issue. If, as we've seen, we haven't got a lot of water into the lake, it's all stayed frozen. So the further down our May 1 and our June 1, the timing, you know, based on the weather and when it's actually warm enough for that snow to actually melt, there's only so much we can do if the water isn't entering the lake. So a little more uncertainty with the May 1 and as you look towards Memorial Day and June 1. And that can kind of be seen by where those target elevations are in our band of historical years here. The May 1 is about right in the middle, almost to the lower end of our blue range there, which is October 1st and June 1, again, is still kind of within that range. So there's less certainty with those earlier target elevations. So thanks for pointing that out.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we've gone a little over our time, actually, so we'd suggest stopping here, and we'll pick up in the afternoon.
Okay, so we will recess for lunch and begin at 1 p.m. our business session.
Thank you.
And come back to order. Is that the right thing you say?
Mm-hmm.
And we now will consider the consent agenda. Do I have a motion for the consent agenda?
Mr. Chairman,
I move.
Go ahead, please.
I still move.
A second.
Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Consent agenda is approved as written. Okay, so number 11.
Number 11 is a resolution approving a request for proposal number 18-91 for general contractor construction manager services and authorizing the general manager of the district to publish notice inviting seal proposals for said project. Good morning. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Lodge, joining us.
David Lodge, project manager, engineering and project management. So you'll recall the last board meeting, Dan Frazier presented our business case findings for the service center and launched our public outreach. So you may be wondering, why am I here asking for an RFP for construction contractor services? So first I want to explain why we are looking at the general contractor construction manager alternative delivery, GCCM delivery, and then answer why now. So as envisioned, this project will be a large, complex project with a lot of coordination. And in order to be successful, we would definitely want to bring a contractor on board early during design. Early involvement helps to alleviate constructability concerns and cost issues before they escalate. So unlike design bid build, GCCM alternative delivery allows us to bring that contractor on board through a qualification basis and price, and then involve early during design, no later than schematic design. So the selection process for a GCCM is based on reviewing qualifications, conducting interviews, and then doing a cost proposal for certain segments of the project, and then making a selection, negotiating a contract, and then ultimately awarding a pre-construction service agreement. That process can take 3 to 4 months to bring the contractor on board, different than a regular bid. So ultimately, this RFP may lead to construction services, which will be in excess of $3 million, which is why we're seeking board approval now. So why are we wanting to start this process now? Even though we're out for public outreach on the project, as this moves forward, we would anticipate bringing all of the feedback that we receive through our public outreach process to the board in April, at which time we would seek direction on the project. If the project does move forward, we'd be ready to start schematic design with the design team, and we'd be ready for a GCCM to come on board in June. So like I mentioned before, the 3 to 4 month lead time to get them on board, we back that up, and we're ready to advertise an RFP now, get them on board in June. So this RFP would not result in a financial commitment until June, at which time we would request board authorization to award the RFP. Any questions?
That just answered my question.
Great.
Yeah, your last statement.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thank you. Is that a question?
He just said thank you.
Thanks, David. So that's the only resolution that we have. Can I get a motion for Resolution 11?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept Resolution 11 as presented to the Commission.
I'll second the motion.
Any discussion? Okay, I'll call for a vote. Those in favor, signify.
Aye.
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 Against? Resolution passes. Back to, do we have any manager items left?
We have one left. I want to invite Kirk up for a special announcement.
Good afternoon. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. With me is Steve Wickle, Transmission Engineering Manager, and Jim Caldwell, Senior Transmission Engineer. It's a privilege and honor to inform you that the district has received what's called a Silver Award, Studies, Research, and Consulting Engineering Services for 2019. It's an Engineering Excellence Award. It's from the American Council of Engineering Companies. And this acrylic award that you see in front of you was actually awarded to the district for the transmission line fire risk assessment work that was presented to you in 2017. I want to make sure that Steve Wickle and Jim get the recognition. There was a lot of hard work that went into that. And I think what was most exciting for me is they were assigned a task in 2017 to perform, you'll remember in the last strategic plan, there was about investing in our assets, and we talked about hardening the transmission distribution system. And so they were assigned a task. It was pretty much along the lines of figure out how to do that. And instead of just taking what they knew and applying what they knew, they went out on their own. Took the initiative, solicited input from a number of experts, ecologists, meteorologists, wildland fire experts, and worked with a consulting firm, HDR, and as a team effort to try and figure out how to do this and do it very well. And so they took information and data collected from disparate sources, put it all together into the wild land fire risk assessment that you saw for our system. And as you know, in the utility industry, wildland fires is a big topic right now. So the work they did is actually what I would say is probably setting the bar for the industry on how to do this, not only across the country, but probably throughout the world. So kudos to the two of them. And just interestingly enough, last week was notified that we actually did receive award at the national level as well, a national recognition award. So the district and HDR both will be recognized at a black tie event on May 7th in Washington, D.C. And it's actually referred to it in their letter as the Academy Awards of Engineering. Anyways, we'd like to make sure the recognition gets passed along to Steve and Jim, and thank you for your support and everything in terms of allowing this team to do the work that they do.
You know, that would be worth attending just to see the two of them in a black tie. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you goes to you guys. So who will be receiving the award?
We're not sure yet. I mentioned it to Chad, and hopefully somebody will get to go and receive that award.
I'm sure somebody will. Thank you, you guys.
Well, thanks for the hard work, and congratulations.
Yeah, yep. That's really good.
Go
ahead, please.
That's on our appreciation, Kirk. Very prestigious honor. And we thank you and your team for being so diligent that it gets a national recognition.
Thank you.
And it means a lot to us right here at the local level, too. That's really cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, well, I love the simplicity of the award.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really is. That's just clean and neat and well said. So the work is stated and the award is understated, and that's a really nice balance.
Yeah. Thank you.
So where are you going to put it?
Don't know yet. Our new office building.
Just a little pressure.
Leave a place for that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We're done with manager items. Okay. Yes.
So we'll move into commission items. First item for us to take care of is a proposed motion. We need to set a meeting date for a MIDC managers and commissioners meeting.
So commissioners, maybe before you actually take action, one of the questions that has come up here late last week is whether we actually still need that motion. When it was put on the agenda, we were expecting three or more of you to attend, and as of, I think, Friday, we might have only two that have indicated. So maybe some discussion amongst yourselves, and then we could decide whether there's a motion or not.
What is it again? I don't have mine in front of me. I'm sorry.
It's for the Mid-C at Bob's Classic in East Wenatchee, March 11th.
I'll be out of town.
I won't be there because I'll be at the Cashmere City Council meeting.
Same here.
So we will only have two, Commissioner Bowles and maybe Commissioner Arsenault.
So we don't
need.
So we would not
attend.
I'm sorry, Commissioner?
I am planning to attend.
So we would just have two, Commissioner Bowles, Commissioner Arsenault, and we would not need the meeting.
Okay.
But that will tie the rest of your hands, and you won't be able to go.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
I was looking for teardrops. But
I know, I didn't see any either.
Commissioners, are there any other commission items?
I have something brief. Anybody else? Anybody else go before me?
No.
Go before I go. So I was just in Portland and Vancouver for an NWPPA meeting, Northwest Public Power Association meeting, and sat with Suzanne Grissel on the way down on the plane and then actually on the way back, too. But Suzanne is thought of as almost a god, seriously, at NWPPA. They rely on her so much. Nicole, who is the government affairs executive. I'm not sure of her exact title. She relies on Suzanne Grissel so much. She shared that with me. She says, I don't know how I'd do my job without Suzanne. And she's not the only one. The director, she's just really highly thought of, and we are so lucky to have her. She just does a terrific job. And when I sit by her and talk to her, she has so much humility, and she's just always reaching out, trying to figure out what she can do better. And she asks me, and I just feel really silly because I don't have a clue. You know, I mean, she's heads and shoulders above me, so it makes me feel silly when she says that to me. She's an amazing individual. So, Suzanne, if you hear this, thank you so much.
I have one, if nobody else does.
Go ahead, Randy.
Last week I had the opportunity to attend the APPA fly-in in Washington, D.C., and it was a well-attended and I think very successful few days in Washington, D.C., but I'd like to share with those in the room the APPA award winner for Champion of American Public Power was Congressman Greg Walden from Oregon. And it was a breakfast meeting. And when Congressman Walden saw Steve Wright in the room, he called him out and just lavished praise on him for a variety of things. I'd like to follow up with Steve and find out about those cab rides they shared from the airport into the city. there, but I just want you to know that your general manager is very highly regarded in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, Randy, thank you for sharing that.
It was nice to have a chauffeur. ready to move on?
I think we're ready.
I think I'm embarrassed enough. So, want to ask Lisa Sanders to come up. While she's coming up, I did realize that I overlooked one manager item I did want to raise with you. Recall that at our last board meeting, we talked about the E3 studies and how the E3 studies indicated that there was a potential for a resource adequacy challenge in the region. So I think to the surprise of most everyone, we had been seeing high prices. I had mentioned to you we've had three high price periods here in the last 6 months, including in the last 2 weeks. And, of course, prices have averaged $25 for a while. They've been, you know, 100, even sometimes 150 in the last month or two. On Friday, they averaged for the weekend $850. And I will tell you that that has definitely got a lot of eyebrows raising, not just in the Northwest but around the country as people talk about these are the highest prices since the energy crisis. So it's been 18 years since we've seen prices like this. We'll have to do the analysis to really understand all the things that are going on. It could be a confluence of anomalous events, but it also strikes many of us that we have been skating close to the edge on resource adequacy for a while, and this may well be a harbinger of things to come in the future. So more to come on this. We'll see whether, in fact, it's can be offered as validation of the study work that's been done. But certainly it suggests that at least there's a problem out there. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Hey, Lisa Sanders, admin and finance. I'm here to cover travel with commissioners. I have Commissioner Congdon traveling for NWPPA this week.
Quarterly board meeting.
Quarterly board meeting. March 13 to 15, we have Waputa meetings in Olympia. Like, as of now, everyone attending except Commissioner Congdon. Correct?
Do we have that discovery?
That is on the 15th. So you weren't going to attend, I thought. That's a Thursday.
Are you going to the discovery meeting?
I think so. Is that the 14th? I think so. I think I'll be back. I'm going to try to get back.
Yes, I need to get back with you, but it looks like I may not be attending that either. But I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
Okay.
End of March, we have Commissioner Congdon traveling for the quarterly Water Committee meeting. You still...
Question mark. Okay. If I can't travel, I'll be calling in for it, but I hope to be able to go.
So we'll just have to...
It's in Olympia. I'll be in touch with you.
For the hotel?
Yeah.
Okay. We have April Association meetings. I have rooms held for everyone. Does everyone plan to attend?
Yes.
Do you have me going in on Tuesday night? It should be Wednesday, Lisa.
I just have the 17th. I don't know which day that is.
I'm pretty sure that's a Wednesday because you've got me on the 16th, and I should be a Tuesday.
Yes.
17th is Wednesday.
Is that what you wanted?
Yes.
Yep.
In the 17th and back the 19th.
Okay.
Thank you.
I don't think this is reflected on your forms, but late last week I did hold rooms for NWPPA in Sacramento and APPA in Austin.
Lisa?
Yes?
This is Gary, and I will be unable to go to Austin.
Okay. Thank you. So if you're making your own flight arrangements, if you can get that to me so I can include it in your expense reports and Also, I can firm up your hotel dates. That would be great and get us a step closer to having all your receipts also. Or if you need me to make those, I can help you with those as well. Then we have, didn't we? Commissioner Congdon Water Committee in June. That makes sense. We just have one of those. March. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, every quarter. I'll let you know, probably.
Commissioner Smith, we have this training, the LEHI.
Right, correct.
Do you have a hotel preference in Richland?
Let me check with APPA. They may be making those reservations because I believe they are covering the expenses.
Okay. And who plans on attending the policymakers in July? I have Commissioner Smith.
I'm definitely going.
Look, put me down, Lisa. This is Gary. I would like to go.
Okay.
Probably not.
Okay. Commissioner Congdon?
No. Where is it?
Arlington?
Washington. Huh?
Yeah, no. Nope.
Okay.
No.
All right. And I'm not sure what this OPUDA annual conference is.
Oregon PUD that, Association.
Oh.
Yeah, and I will be going to that as the president of the PUD Association.
Oh, okay. Anyone else interested?
No.
No.
You know where that will be held? I do not know any details yet.
I don't either.
Lisa, tentatively, I would be interested in attending.
Okay. Okay, do you want to...
Is that far enough?
Go any further? It's up to you.
Maybe we're getting out.
I think we're good.
Yeah, I think so, okay. Too. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
No, in July, Waputa is here, right?
It is. That is, in my understanding, it's going to be at the end.
Yes. At the end.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks. And I'll come see you about this.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Follow up on delegation of action items from previous board meeting.
We had only one, and it was an email from Justin that you received the same day of the meeting last week. So. Should be taken care of.
And delegation of items for today.
We've got three. So first of all, from the Rock Island projects and loan presentation, the outstanding balances of current debt for Rock Island. And second, the incremental investment analysis for Rock Island projects. And third, just for Justin to be thinking about as he comes back next time, the emerging themes from strategic planning.
Steve, if I may, commissioners, you should have in your inbox a short email from me on the parking lot item relative to the cause of California fires. You might remember several meetings ago.
Did see that. Yes. So thank you.
That's in there. It's a living document. We'll continue to modify it or update it as it reports become available. But if you have any questions, please reach out. I can answer.
It's a living document and an eye-opening document.
Oh, well, I thought so, too.
Just a quick question. Is anybody else having trouble getting receiving mail on their new iPads remotely? I'll go a couple days and not receive any, and so then I know something's wrong and I'll reboot. I've been able to reboot it several. I'll go to IT. But nobody else is having that issue?
Well, I may be, but I don't know. not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And then an additional public comment.
here. Matters of general business as they may necessarily come before the commission. Do we have anything else? Executive session?
Let's say 45 minutes. 60 minutes, just to be sure.
Okay. So we will adjourn this time into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, or and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 4230110. We're coming out of executive session. It's March 4th. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned. 208.